is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome to Hometown Heroes. I'm your host, Paul Leffler. This will be our last program for 2007. Look forward to a great year of Hometown Heroes in 2008. And before we go any further, I want to send our condolences out to the family of Nick Eichen of Clovis, the 6th Buchanan High School graduate to be killed in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. He, of course, died serving in Afghanistan. And if you ever talk to these veterans, as I have for the last few years with the World War II generation, each one of them who came home from the war will tell you the true heroes are the ones that didn't come home. And now 6 of those heroes, hometown heroes here in the Valley from Buchanan High School in Clovis. So our thoughts and prayers go out to that family as they mourn, and we thank them for their service and their sacrifice to our country. I also want to mention, before we get to today's guest, a great article in the Fresno Bee yesterday by Ron Orozco in the Life section on one of the gentlemen you've heard on this program, Dr. Stan Lindquist, who, of course, lost his eye, part of his leg, in a minefield in Germany, and has a great story to tell. The story in the Fresno Bee yesterday, if you haven't seen it, check that Life section out or go online to look at it. But a great job by Ron Orozco in capturing the spirit of Dr. Stan Lindquist, and talks about his book that's out now, Letters from Private Buck, Devotionals from World War II Combat, a great book that you can pick up at the Link Care Center in Fresno on West Shaw Avenue. Now, as for today's program, we'll talk to another World War II veteran, a Marine. And when you say a Marine in the Pacific in World War II, certain images come to your mind. But it's a little different twist today as we welcome in my good friend Bill Kelleher. Bill, how are you today?
I'm fine, Paul. How's everything with you?
Good. Good to talk to you. And Bill, when I caught up with him for our TV Stories of Service, was here in Fresno. Since then, he's moved up to the California Veterans Home in Yountville, and I think that's something that we can start with today, Bill, before we get into your service, since we are going to have the Central California Veterans Home here in Fresno in the not-too-distant future. How much do you love being up there in Yountville, and what are the kinds of things that you get to experience there at the Veterans Home?
Oh, boy, I tell you, this place is great, Paul. I'm happier here than I've been in the last 4 years. Part of the reason, you know, and it just has proved to be absolutely fabulous. The place is beautiful to begin with. You know, it's about 500 acres here, and we have all sorts of activities to do. One of my biggest problems is making sure that I don't eat myself to death.
Too much good food, huh?
They feed us like you wouldn't believe. It just really is a marvelous place, and all sorts of things to keep you busy. And, of course, health-wise, they look out after you like you are their own. You know, I spend quite a bit of my time at the hospital going with various tests that they're putting you through and all. And And after the first of the year, I'm going to be having a cataract removed from my right eye, and they think that I'll then have 20/20 in both eyes, which will be nice. I'm through the probationary period now, so I do have more time to myself than I had at the beginning. And, well, there are just all kinds of stuff here to keep you busy. You know, they have a 1,000-seat theater where we can have symphonies, plays, concerts, and so forth. Just here a couple of weeks ago, we had the stage show Evita, and let's see, the...
You really are staying busy over there, aren't you?
I'm under what?
I said you really are staying busy up there, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, gosh, yes. The golf courses and or golf course and bowling alleys and a big library, computer classes, you know, 2 museums, fitness centers, game rooms.
Wow.
The whole darn bit. It's just, it's great.
Well, it's a lot for the Valley to look forward to once our veterans here have those same kind of amenities. And I'm sorry that it wasn't built soon enough for you to stick around these parts, because I know there are a lot of folks here that miss you, but we're very happy that you're so happy up there.
Well,
one more question about that.
I just hope that yours turns out as well, and I'm sure it will.
Amen. Amen. Hey, as far as the camaraderie there, I imagine when you've got a lot of aging soldiers hanging out around each other with Marines and Navy guys and the guys who are up in the sky and all of that, you trade a lot of stories with your neighbors?
Well, yeah, you do. And I'll tell you something else. We also have women veterans here.
Well, it'd be awfully boring if you didn't, wouldn't it?
That's right. And of course, we have visitors come up quite frequently, and the guys get together. We have I think that when you are talking with someone who's in his 50s, that you're on the lower end of the age bracket, because they go on up from there. As you know, I'm 86 now, and we have one Marine here who is 94. He's the oldest Marine on the base, and an amazing fellow. He still walks everywhere. He has a pretty good appetite and seems to be in good health, and we have a lot of fellows who have lost limbs, you know, and they use electric carts, which are furnished to them, and there are about as many electric carts around here, actually, for the ones who are unable to do a lot of walking as there are automobiles and so forth. The dining hall is a wonderful place to meet people. It's a lovely dining area, and they have one area that is for people who are unable to all carry trays and stuff like that, and they serve them. The other people who are able to do it go through a mess line and carry their trays to their tables, but that is fine and dandy, and you just run into all sorts of personalities and different fellows or people from different services, and of course you always try to outdo the other guy, but that's just par for the course.
Got to stay close to the truth, though.
Right. Now, of course, you don't exaggerate. You just tell the truth.
We're talking to Bill Kelleher, who used to live here in the Valley, since has moved up to the California Veterans Home in Yountville. He's given us a little bit of a preview of what the Valley can expect once that Central California Veterans Home is built, most likely in West Fresno, in the years ahead. I do want to get, before we get our first commercial in here, Bill, I want to talk a little bit about when you got into the service. You told us you're 86 now. You were about 21 in 1942 when Uncle Sam got a hold of you. Tell us about what you were doing at the time and how you ended up in the Marine Corps.
Well, I was a newspaper photographer working on paper where my father was editor.
Kansas City Journal, right?
Kansas City Journal, yeah. And he had been in the newspaper business for many, many, many years. My older brother was in it also. And I guess when the war came along, my second oldest brother, Dan, was one of the early draftees. He had the lucky number. And after he went in, I decided, well, I was going to volunteer. So I went and signed up for the Marine Corps. They sent me out to San Diego to boot camp, and of course I assumed that I was going to be a photographer. That's what I was hoping for, and they assigned me to photography, and the only thing was that instead of being a still cameraman, which I knew, they decided I was going to be a movie cameraman, and I didn't know beans about that. So went to school at 20th Century Fox, and after a while, they had enough confidence that they put me to work as a motion picture cameraman, and that's what I did during the war.
Now, when you first got assigned to motion pictures, and I know you had loved still photography since the time you were probably 11 or 12 years old, were you upset that you didn't get to be one of the still photo guys?
Well, no, not really. I mean, the only thing was that I wasn't as sure of myself as I would have been if I'd been in still photography, but it was fun, and it was interesting, and I never really regretted it that much. The funny thing is, though, that since I've gotten out, I haven't shot a doggone foot of motion pictures. Everything I do is still. So I went back to the original thing. The only thing is that now it's the digital age, and where I knew speed graphics and that sort of camera, and the ones with the ground glass for viewing and all, these new digital, which I'm like a babe in the woods, so I'm learning all over again, and I feel pretty stupid sometimes.
Oh, don't we all when it comes to those?
I'm
sure you're in the same boat I'm in. But more than 60 years ago, you're in a different kind of boat, and you saw some things through the lens of that camera that I know are still etched into your memories today. And before we get to all that, we need to get a commercial break in here, Bill, so if you can hang on the line for us, we'll be right back with Bill Kelleher, a World War II cinematographer. We'll talk about what he saw through that lens and his experiences since then when Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is a World War II cinematographer by the name of Bill Kelleher. He used to live here in Fresno. He has since moved to the California Veterans Home in Yountville, something that the Valley will get to experience soon, at least something similar when the Central California Veterans Home opens up. Bill told us how much he's enjoying it up there, but now we'll get to some material, some circumstances that weren't as much enjoyable when he was deployed in the Pacific during World War II. And Bill, your first taste of combat was something that I don't know if anything could have prepared you for it. And you talked about getting used to shooting motion pictures as opposed to still photos. Before you actually got into combat and started rolling film on all this kind of stuff, did you imagine in your mind how difficult it would be to watch all that?
I don't think I had any idea of what it was going to be like. It was brand new experience, believe me.
You know, we had as our guest a few weeks ago a gentleman from Sanger by the name of Bob Baird, who was a frogman in World War II. And one of the things that he talked about was that they learned at the Battle of Tarawa, which he was not there, he came after that, but one thing they learned is that they needed those frogmen in there to look at those underground reefs and blow some of them up so the boats wouldn't get hung up on them and they could actually make it to the shore. And that's what he did the rest of the war, at least in the Pacific there, was they would go in, do reconnaissance, figure out where they had to lay some explosives and blow some holes in the reefs so the boats could get in. You didn't have that benefit at Tarawa, and I know that that was had a big impact on what you did and what you saw. Describe for us if you can.
It was the thing that caused so much damage to our troops, or so many deaths and wounds and so forth, because the Amtraks got hung up on the reef, on the coral and one thing and another, and we had to walk in about 600 yards to shore, and the beach where I landed, they had us being fired on from both left and right sides and the front. So, you know, just all kinds of crossfire, and there were so many guys that they never did reach shore. They died in the water before they even got to land. And
that was one of the things, when I first heard your story, that really blew me away, was not necessarily that you survived that, which is impressive enough on its own, but that what you had to do and the fact that you still survived, because here are all these Marines around you, and like you say, you've got gunfire coming from both ways as you try to get onto this tiny little island that they later called in the title of an acclaimed book, One Square Mile of Hell. Here you are trying to get onto the island, wading through 600 yards of water. These guys are crouching down to try to avoid the bullets, and you couldn't do that. Tell us why not.
Well, my buddy Norm Hatch and I, we had to walk standing up because we had camera belts and all with the cameras and film and everything, and we couldn't duck down because we would ruin the film, and that there would be no reason for us to even try to get ashore. So we just we were really walking bullseyes, I thought. But the thing that we never have understood is that with all the guys that got killed and hurt and some of them blown apart and some of them just ripped apart by machine gun fire and one thing and another, he and I never got a scratch. In fact, in all of the invasions we made, none of us had any kind of serious wounds other than Ray Majasek on Saipan lost a leg. And out of our whole group, we went all through these things and never got hurt, and we still don't know the answer to that. We talk about that frequently. Norm and I, we're the only two survivors left now, after all these years, due to old age, I guess. But it just was it was a very enlightening experience. I tell you, you learn quickly what was going to be going on, and you still couldn't believe it, but it just was it was fantastic operation.
Well, and that Battle of Tarawa, which of course is November of 1943 in the Gilbert Islands, 1,001 Marines were killed, more than 2,000 were wounded, 4,500 Japanese were killed. Only 17 of them were left on that island at the end of that battle after 4 days to surrender. But I think that you saw some of the most vivid images before you could even get set up and start rolling.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, I think the very first thing that I saw, you know, after we got on the shore, we had a beachhead of, I don't know, you know, 15 or 20 feet, I don't know, but in off to the side in front of me, a Marine had been hit, and a Navy corpsman was treating him, and one of the snipers got the corpsman right through the cheek, you know, and he just started bleeding, and he put his hand up and drew it away, and it just covered with blood. He reached into his pack and he got one of those heavy bandages they have, and he put that up on his face, you know, he just patted it in place and it stuck, and he went back and worked on the Marine. I said, I thought that was the very first thing I saw like that. I said, God, that guy needs a medal. As far as I was concerned, he would have had one. And that sort of thing happened frequently. So those guys were tremendous. They really did a whale of a job. A lot of guys survived because of the work that they and doctors did.
Well, and the work that you did was important, too. I want to talk a little bit more about that in a second. First, I don't want to gloss past this. Here you are wading through the water. I imagine that water wasn't Pacific blue. It probably had a pretty good red tint.
It was red in a lot of places, up near the shore especially. It was turning red. The bodies were floating in the water up there. Just so many guys that got hit, and they couldn't make it. And some of them, of course, were dead. But the bodies were floating, and there was a lot of blood to flow too.
And that couldn't have been encouraging for you or anybody around you. What goes through your head? Do you think, what am I doing here? How am I even going to think about getting this camera out of my pack and shooting some film here?
Well,
what am I doing?
These are things, I don't know, Paul. I think that the adrenaline must be flowing rapidly or excessively rapidly, because you don't stop to think about that, because you're supposed to be getting pictures of the action, and there certainly was plenty of action there, and so that's what we were doing. After it was over, you know, you sit down and stop and think about it, and you know, my God, how did I get through that, or how come I didn't get touched, and all these other guys, things happened to them. You know, it's a funny feeling. But when it actually was going on, I really don't think that we thought about it.
Didn't really have time to, I guess.
No, that's right.
What did you do? Did you try to find a place with a little bit of cover and just...
Well, you tried, but there wasn't very much cover on that island. You know, it was only a mile and a half long and a half mile wide, and golly, I mean, there just was no elevation to it at all. The highest point on the island was the Japanese, what was the headquarters, and it was like a huge, a very heavily enforced room that rose up possibly 15 to 20 feet, and that was the highest spot on the island.
This is this reinforced blockhouse that you've seen pictures of?
That thing, it had sloped sides, and they used coconut logs that were crisscrossed, and then in cement. They were about 8 feet thick, and before we landed, the Navy just bombarded the living daylights out of the thing. You know, I mean, they were shooting 1,000-pound shells over there, and they didn't make a dent in that thing. And the way we finally got them out, or the way the troops finally got them out, was dropping hand grenades and charges down the air vents and smoke, you know, to smoke them out. And then when they came out, they got shot. But the bombardment just didn't faze that thing. Talk about armor plate, boy, those coconut logs and that cement, they were really something. And the guys, the Japanese came pouring out of there. There was one entrance that I guess was the only entrance to it, because that's where they all came out, and they just were sitting ducks at that point. I mean, they didn't stand a chance. Throughout the island, the Japanese were masters at digging in, you know, and camouflaging, and you don't know they're there. They were using smokeless powder, and guys are getting popped off, and you didn't know where the fire was coming from, because there was no smoke when the shells were, you know, when the bullets were shot, or when they were shot, and you had to dig them out. We used flamethrowers in most of the places, you know, to force them out, and as I say, when it was all over, they just had the 17 of them left.
It's hard to believe. I want to talk a little more about what you were doing all this time and how much you actually got to roll film, because you didn't have that much film. What was it, about 20 feet of film in each roll?
No, 100.
100 feet.
100 feet, yeah. But the cameras we were using, they were IMO three turret lens cameras, 35-millimeter film, 100-foot spools, and they were hand-cranked. And, you know, you'd be filming, and all of a sudden you have to stop and crank up some more. Later on, we had the ones that would just keep going, but those cameras at that time were hand-crank deals, and so you only got a few minutes of shooting, you know, with a crank, and then you had to stop and do it again. So it was a case of one guy, if he ran out, the other guy would load up and shoot, and or be shooting, and then the fellow would reload his camera. We just went back and forth, you know, that way, so that we tried to get all the action all the time, didn't lose anything.
Are there some specific images that stick out in your mind, or pieces, sequences of film that you captured, that you saw through your lens? You talked about the corpsman getting hit in the face, having half his face blown off, but you weren't rolling film on that yet. Tell us some of the things that you did.
Hadn't gotten my camera. That would have been one of the crackerjack things to have, because after that, the most of the stuff that we saw was the battle itself. There was one spot where Norm Hatch was my buddy, and he got a few frames of Japanese and American troops firing at one another. This was up at that blockhouse, and I think that was the only film shot during the war, as far as I know, where it showed both sides in the same frames shooting at one another. Most of it was you shooting at them, them shooting at you, but not at the same time, and showing both of them. And it just was quite a spectacular shot. And
did you ever have any moments where you're shooting something and you almost got shot, or you were a little too close to the action, had to find another point of view?
The bullets were free. I mean, you know, they probably were very close to me, but when you've got your eye up there, that eyepiece, and you've got one eye in the eyepiece, the other eye's closed, I guess, and you don't realize it. Once in a while, you'd hear something whistling by, but you didn't know whether it was real close or to the side of you. But as I say, someone was sure looking out for us, because we were in the thick of it and never got touched. It must have been close. I mean, that was a Tarawa. I had a couple of close ones other times, you know, during the war. But that one was the one that I never will understand how we got through that one that way, without being hit.
Well, I'm sure glad you did. And I want to hear about those other close calls, too. We do need to sneak in another commercial, if you can stick with us through that.
Okay.
We'll do that, and we'll hear about your close calls and find out what happened to all that film you shot at Tarawa and what was done with it after the film made it back to the U.S. This is Bill Kelleher, our guest. I'm Paul Leffler on Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to the program, our last of 2007. We look forward to many more wonderful stories from our proud veterans in 2008. And I want to thank all those who are out there serving our country right now and putting their lives on the line for the red, white, and blue. That's what Bill Kelleher did during World War II. Bill's from Kansas City, so Bill, I should tell you that the Chiefs just lost in overtime to the Jets, 13-10.
How about that? It's okay.
Sorry to break the bad news.
Yeah, I know. That's what happens.
You were in Kansas City before the Chiefs were there. So
yes, I was.
You predate them there.
Yeah.
Let's get back to World War II, and specifically the Battle of Tarawa. We talked about how brutal that was, and part of the way that America found out how brutal it was the work that you did, and that those like you did in capturing those images, both still and moving, as you were using a moving picture camera, a film camera, to capture some of that. Tell us what happened to all those feet and feet of film after you were done at Tarawa, after the battle was over. And don't just tell us what happened. Tell us when you found out what happened to that film.
Okay. To start off with, the movie, the combat film that we did on that, we had more fellows in the section than Norm and me, but we were lucky enough that we were the only ones got ashore the first couple of days, lucky or unlucky, however you look at it. But the other fellows came in. But during the time that we were there and before they were able to get ashore, we had shot so much film. We were the only ones doing it, you know, the only ones there that were doing the film. And you didn't really have to do anything except aim the camera because, my God, the action was going on around you all the time. And so the other fellows came in, and the last day of the operation, it only lasted 72 hours total, and so they did shooting too. But all the film was put together as shot by the team, and it was sent back to the States for developing, or I guess it went to Hawaii and then from there to the States. And it turned out that President Roosevelt was trying to jack up the purchase of savings bonds, and he saw the film, and he decided that the people in the country ought to see what it was like, and that maybe that would help jack up the sale of the bonds, too. So it was shown throughout in theaters throughout the United States, and I guess that it really did jack up the sales of bonds and so forth. And after the war was over, Norm and I found out that the film had been given a special Oscar at the Academy Awards in 1944. We didn't even know about it. And the Oscar went to the Marine Corps. Hang on, I got a call coming. I'm going to just cut it off for the moment.
You're a popular guy.
Yeah, no.
And I want to let people know the name of that film in case they want to try to track it down somewhere. It's With the Marines at Tarawa.
Yeah.
And that was the Academy Award for Best Documentary Short in 1944.
Yes, that's correct. And the Oscar, or the award went to the Marine Corps, and the Oscar went to General Smith, who was the commanding general. And it, in turn, ended up in the museum at Quantico, in the Marine Museum. That's where it is now. And although the thing went to the division and all that, we were pretty happy about the fact that we were involved in it.
Well, you should be. And in my opinion, I think you and Norm should have Oscars, too. I think they should give you those statuettes. But
well,
not even the Marine Corps
know,
got one.
Those things are costly, and they don't hand them out like that. But we're just happy that the thing did. Because, as you say, from your fellow who was on, the Frogman, that was that's one of the things that comes from the films that we shoot, because they study you know, how the opposition works against us and what's going on and how we react to it and one thing and another, and that's how they learn on these things. And that, of course, was the initial amphibious assault by the Marine Corps. That was the first time they'd had an assault like that, amphibious. And so they learned from it. And just the stuff that happens on these films. So it did a lot of good.
Well, I think so, and I think it's safe to say too that maybe some of the lessons there saved some lives along the way with the rest.
Oh yeah, yes, it definitely has. That's the idea of it. That it is used for training and so forth afterward too. You know, and for intelligence purposes, we worked out of the intelligence section of the division. We were division intelligence personnel, so it. It definitely is a good thing that they do.
Did you ever find yourself in a spot, Bill, where you were out of film or had the film stuck in the camera or dropped your film in the sand or anything like that?
God, no, don't let things like that happen. No, we always were able to keep going. As I say, if one of us was out, the other guy was covering because we were working as a team. So it worked out well.
Now, you said that outside of Tarawa and other engagements that you had some close calls.
One went through a bag, that carried film in, which was slung over my shoulder and on my side, and it went through the bag. That was the closest I got. Now, at least that's the closest I know of.
Where was that?
That was on Saipan.
You were glad you had that bag, I guess.
Well, I'm glad that the guy missed me. he can have the bag all he wants, but leave me alone, baby.
and then at some point, you actually got to come back home, and you worked on training films for a while. Is that right?
When I came back, I was sent to Quantico, Virginia, and I worked on training films there and doing. Various types of photography around the base, and of course I was there when World War II ended, and we photographed all the activities and the cheering and so forth, and when President Roosevelt died that was a very, very sad day, of course, there. My God, you guys, crying by the jillions, you know, the place, it just was a very sad time. But the happy thing that happened was that while I was there, I started dating a young lady who was in the Women Marines. When I came back, I didn't even know they had Women Marines. And we started dating and got married, and were married for 52 years before I lost her to old age. As I say, actually, she had a stroke and was paralyzed for 6 years, and she passed away in 1996. But we had 52 happy years.
And you wouldn't have met her if Uncle Sam hadn't put you in.
That's right. That's right. I tell you, I was always indebted to him because that was one of the nicest things that ever could happen to me. And we had a lovely daughter whom I lost last year, but. I feel that I was very fortunate all the way through. I don't have anything bad to say about any of it.
Let me ask you one more thing about the Oscar-winning documentary with the Marines at Tarawa. Once you found out that it had been awarded an Oscar, did you have any events that you got to take part in because you had been a part of that film?
Well, I don't know whether it was that specifically. Or a combination of them, but both Norm and I, we received various citations and one thing and another. I was up at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., presented with a plaque there. I had been interviewed by National Geographic. After the war, they came to my home in Florida and did a film, brought a camera crew down and a director, and had a very nice time there at our home. And my wife was able to see that going on, but she died just before the film was shown on the PBS stations. And then later on, Norm and I were called back to Washington to the National Archives, and this television company from London, England, had us flown in, and they did a film of, or did an interview with us, and it was part of a documentary that they were doing on combat photographers from all the services and around the country. That was quite a long film because there were so many photographers involved in it, you know, that they interviewed over the course of a year and a half or so before they showed it. That ran on PBS and also on BBC in England. And we got various citations in the Marine Corps, you know, and one thing or another. So we were recognized for the efforts, which was nice.
Well, and I know one thing that weighs heavy on your heart is all the guys that you saw during your duty that that didn't come home. And
yeah.
One thing that you did that really impressed me, and this goes for a lot of veterans that I've talked to, that in the midst of war, and you think of this intense experience, but there is downtime in war and so much time to think when you're away from the society that you know. You're there oftentimes alone or forced to be quiet and alone, and you have time to think, you have time to write. And you wrote a beautiful poem about your Marine Corps friends, and I won't put you on the spot just yet. I'll give you a commercial to build up the moxie to read it for us, because I would love to hear it in your voice.
Okay.
And hear the entire thing.
All right.
Marine Corps pal of mine. So
okay.
You get ready. We'll take one last break, and when we come back, we'll hear Bill Kelleher's poem written back in 1945, but still very powerful today, Marine Corps pal of mine. That's next on Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Hey, Ken.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Man, an hour can go by fast when you're visiting with a good friend like Bill Kelleher, who used to live here in Fresno. Now he's at the California Veterans Home in Yountville. Gave us a little preview of things to come here in the Valley once we get the Central California Veterans Home. You've heard him talk about his experiences in the Pacific during World War II when he was a cinematographer capturing the heroism of United States Marines on the island of Tarawa, that small one-square-mile island that started it all as far as amphibious assaults by American forces in the Pacific. And somewhere during all that, as the guns were being shot, the explosives were going off, he was seeing all these indelible images, Bill had the time to write a little poem, which he has kept in his wallet for the last 62 years. And I asked him just before our break if he thought he could read it for us, and I think he's willing. So, Bill, we'll let you take it away, and I do have a copy of it here in case you get in trouble there, but I've got faith in you.
Okay. All right. Marine Corps pal of mine, his name may be O'Shaughnessy, Levinsky, or Plain Smith, but he's the sort of fellow you can ride the river with. From east or west or north or south, from city or small town, you'll find him in there pitching when the chips are all laid down. He'll ride a crate or drive a jeep or toss a hand grenade and do it with the same aplomb as when he's on parade. In short, he's just a fellow you can't keep from liking fine. No fancy Dan, that all-E-man Marine Corps pal of mine. The monkeys from the rising sun will always rue the day they fell upon Pearl Harbor in their sneaking, treacherous way. He'll make them freeze, those nepotes who thought they knew the score when they took the Philippines in wake and captured Singapore. Perhaps a Yank from the northern flank of the good old USA, or a Johnny Reb, a southern Deb, waits for her down Dixie way. Missouri's hills might be his home, or Kansas across the line, but his rightful place is in my heart, that fighting pal of mine. He may even be from Brooklyn and pronounce it Boyd for bird, or be a gangling Texan whose main job was riding herd. A Massachusetts highbrow or an unnamed hamlet clown, you can bet your bottom dollar he'll never let you down. You may be a Georgia cracker or a Minnesota Swede, or come from any other place his country felt the need. But whence he came or when or why, he's doing mighty fine and backing up my every play, that Boondocks pal of mine. At Guadalcanal and Bougainville, at Tarawa and Saipan, he took the best the Nips could give and measured up a man. He beat him in the jungles and he whipped him in the sky, and if he died, he showed him how a leatherneck should die. His name might be O'Shaughnessy, Levinsky, or Plain Smith. The chaplains didn't ask him just what church he worshipped with. But if perchance another man now holds his place in line, we'll hear his whisper from above. Good luck, old pal of mine.
That's beautiful, Bill. And I knew you could do it. And good luck, old pal of mine. And I know that brings to Bill's mind so many of his pals who he didn't see after those brutal few days on the island of Tarawa. Bill, thank you for writing that and for sharing it with us. It is very remarkable and one of the best that I've seen. And I think it really captures the spirit of the Marines at that time and just that general fact that they were from all over the place. Their lives were interrupted. They went to war for their country. And for us who are here today, we have them to thank. And thank you, Bill, for capturing that, for sharing it with us. Was there a specific place and time that you wrote that you remember?
Yeah, that was after Saipan. When Saipan finished, there's Saipan and Tinian, and then I had time before I came back home, and that's when it was written. And incidentally, you saw it when it was in my wallet, and it was getting very, very fragile.
Yes.
I wanted to let you know that it's in front of me now, and it's in good shape because Melinda, her brother, does framing work, and he took it and he did something to give more body to it, you know, mounted it somehow or other, and then he put it in, it's in a beautiful frame, it's not in my wallet anymore, and it'll last a long time now.
Well, I am glad to hear that because I was a little concerned. It was paper thin, and 60-something years will do that, I guess. But
yeah,
I'm very glad to hear that.
Yeah. So it's in much better shape now than it was when you saw it originally.
Well, and it's still just as powerful. The words still ring as true and as emotional.
Yeah.
So, Bill, thanks again for that, and thank you for spending this hour with us. Anything else you want to say to your friends back here in the Valley or to those listening?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. The weather here is much more comfortable than Fresno. In the summertime, right now we're having cool weather, and I get up about 4 o'clock in the morning, and when we go to breakfast, it's been in the 20s and 30s and 40s recently, so I'm still wearing my shorts, but I'm going to have to go to long pants pretty soon, I think.
Well, hopefully you can get out there and swing a few clubs on the golf course.
I wish I could do that, but I'm not able to do that anymore, but I sure think about it.
Well, we think about you here, Bill, and we very much appreciate your time, your service to our country, and keep fighting the good fight up there. Hopefully we'll see you soon.
Okay, sir. Thank you much.
That's Bill Kelleher, our guest this week, a World War II cinematographer in the Pacific. Some great stories to tell, and that poem just blows me away every time I hear it because you could just feel the emotion, the bond that those men had with each other all those years ago. We're out of time for Hometown Heroes this week. We'll be back with you in 2008 each and every Sunday from 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock. I'm Paul Leffler. Thanks for listening today on News Talk 580 KMJ.